Do we have a deal to raise the federal debt ceiling and cut spending?
Lawmakers say there could be a deal by the end of the week.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, June 22nd.
Coming up, we'll speak with one of the chief negotiators in Washington who's trying to reach a deal to raise the nation's borrowing limit and cut spending.
We're going to find out just how much savings can come from a troop drawdown in Afghanistan as President Obama prepares to speak on the subject tonight.
And finally, Steve, the airplane industry has resolved the biggest problem of all. People who accidentally press the call button when they just want to turn on the reading light.
Those stories and more, ding, just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Lawmakers in Washington are working frantically trying to reach a deal to raise the $14.3 trillion federal borrowing limit in exchange for trillions of dollars in spending cuts. Well, the Treasury Department has set an August deadline for a debt ceiling increase to keep the nation from defaulting. But lawmakers are trying to reach a deal before the 4th of July recess.
Democratic Congressman Chris Van Hollen is one of the chief debt ceiling negotiators for his party, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So will there be a deal to raise the debt ceiling and cut spending and or raise taxes by the end of this week, do you think?
Well, we're working very hard to get an agreement in principle, either by the end of this week or the end of next, or reach the point where we recognize we can't get a deal. But everybody's working very hard to try and reach an agreement.
And an agreement in principle, you mean sort of lay out a framework but not write it into law right away?
That's right. It would take some time to translate whatever agreement in principle may be reached into law.
What about this idea from the Republican Senate leadership about a temporary increase in the debt limit to sort of satisfy the markets, and then you have another debate on cuts later this year or early next year?
Well, we're very focused on trying to raise the debt ceiling in a way that runs through the end of next year. We think having to do a series of debt ceiling increases actually creates more uncertainty in the marketplace. Better to get it done all at once if we can.
If we're talking about trillions of dollars in cuts to go along with trillions of dollars in debt limit increases, how do you expect those to be felt by ordinary Americans?
Whatever we do, we need to make sure that it has no negative impact on jobs. I'm not saying people won't feel it, but the idea is to have the impact spread out over a period of time so you don't have a big jolt to the economy.
If there were no Republicans in Washington, would your preference be to just raise the debt limit with no cuts, no tax increases?
If forced to choose between a deficit reduction plan that hurt the fragile economy and was unbalanced compared to raising the debt ceiling, I would raise the debt ceiling. We need to make sure we do not default. That would create an economic catastrophe, not my words, those of Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. And playing a game of chicken with defaulting on the debt is a very dangerous game.
Democratic Congressman Chris Van Hollen, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And let's get some analysis now from Richard DeKayser. He's an economist with the Parthenon Group, and he's with us from Boston, as he is every Wednesday. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Richard, it seems like whatever happens, if something happens this week, that it's going to have some pretty big implications for the economy if we're talking about trillions of dollars.
Well, that's right. You know, the talk all along has been about kicking the can down the road a few months and revisiting this, but the congressman just mentioned something which gets us past the election season, and that would be large. That is to say, it would involve likely large budget cuts over many years. And the key issue here, the absolute critical issue, is the timing. Most of our budget woes are really long-term issues, and they mostly speak to things like entitlements such as Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare. Short run, there's actually been talk of being lenient and even persisting tax cuts like the payroll tax cut we had this year. So it could be very big and the timing is going to be critical.
So maybe add to the deficit in the short run, get the economy going and make the big cuts in the long run. Would markets be satisfied with a deal like that?
The markets would be satisfied if one critical thing was met, that is, they were given assurance that these long-term commitments would be met, something which was hard-coded into the legislation that would prevent spending from increasing, for example, above certain levels without being financed by taxes. That would assure Wall Street.
What about the other big story, Richard, that's going on in D.C. today, the Fed wrapping up its two-day meeting? Anything we should pay attention to on that front?
I think, relatively speaking, this one's going to be a sleeper. I think the Fed's not going to change interest rates. They're not going to announce any major new programs to buy securities, as they've been doing for the past couple of years. And in part, I think the Fed's tranquility reflects everything we've been talking about. As long as this huge uncertainty is going on the tax front, the Fed's going to have a great incentive to wait and see how it all plays out.
Richard DeKayser, economist with the Parthenon Group, thanks so much as always.
My pleasure.
We're going to dig deeper now into that Fed meeting today with Tad Revell. He is Chief Investment Officer at the firm TCW right here in Los Angeles, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Tad.
Good morning.
There's a lot of, it seems, pretty bad economic news out there. What kind of message are we going to hear from Chairman Bernanke and from the Fed today?
There is a lot of bad economic news out there. We've seen it with Greece, and we've seen it with the weak economic data of recent months. And so Bernanke may characterize this recent period as simply transitory and something that we're going to get over. Or potentially he might say that this is something more alarming and of deeper concern to the Fed. But more than likely it's going to be the first and not the second.
The Fed's bond buying program, we know it is quantitative easing, is expected to wrap up at the end of the month. How are you and I going to be affected by that?
Probably we're not going to notice it at all.
Really?
We don't actually think that the bond buying program, as you characterize it, really has had much of an impact at all on the overall economy. But we'll hear from Bernanke later on today as to whether or not he's going to abide by that path to normalization.
All right, so we're done with the bond buying. What can the Fed do?
They've already done probably everything that they can do. We already are in an environment of zero interest rates. We're in an environment where the Fed has bought quite literally trillions of dollars worth of securities. And I think that we're simply recognizing some limits to the extent to which monetary policy, interest rate policy, can actually influence the course of events.
There's so much going on these days. You mentioned Greece at the outset, the Fed stimulus program we just talked about. Congress and the president negotiating the debt ceiling, that's going on, and it's been pretty tumultuous there. As an investor, what are you most worried about?
The fiscal situation is very unresolved. And so that the real question is, what extent is there going to be a game of brinksmanship that's going to get played? Typically, when
you mean
issues,
chicken, right?
It's
who's
going to
blink first?
Right. And I think that it's actually probably reasonable to think that both parties are going to have to show their constituents that they've gone right to the mat on this one. And so it's going to spook the markets.
Tad Revell, Chief Investment Officer at TCW in Los Angeles. Tad, thank you.
Thank you.
FedEx says it was able to offset the rising cost of the fuel it takes to fly all those packages around with surcharges on shipping rates. The company said this morning earnings rose 33% last quarter.
Google has reached 1 billion unique visitors a month. That's according to new figures from Comscore. That's up 8% from last year.
8%. And if you're feeling lucky, head on over to marketplace.org and tell us what you think of the podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at Marketplace Radio. I am on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm at Radio Geo.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective, President Obama will talk tonight about his plans for a troop drawdown in Afghanistan. He's expected to announce plans to pull 10,000 U.S. forces out of the country within the next year. So what are the cost implications for such a withdrawal? Todd Harrison is the Senior Fellow for Defense Budget Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He's with us now. Good morning, sir.
Hello.
What kind of costs are we talking about to get the troops out of Afghanistan?
Well, there are a number of factors involved here. It's quite a logistical challenge just to pick up and move a force that's been there for almost a decade. We're looking at not only transporting troops back, but dismantling operating bases, packing up equipment, and bringing all of that home. It could cost, you know, billions of dollars, but at the same time, by not having the troops there, we'll be saving an enormous amount of money.
Well, just to put it into perspective, how much money are we talking about to keep the troops there?
Over the past 5 years or so, it's cost us an average of $1.2 million per troop per year in Afghanistan. So as we draw down our forces, we'll be saving over $1 million per troop that we bring out.
Historically, how would winding down a war in Afghanistan compare to, say, other wars and conflicts that we've been through in this country?
Undersecretary for Acquisition Ash Carter, he's referred to Afghanistan as probably the second most logistically difficult place to operate in the world, second only to Antarctica.
Ooh.
Simply because it's a landlocked country. The land routes into Afghanistan are 1,000 miles over hostile terrain, requiring security all along the way. And the country itself has very little infrastructure. So, you know, that's really what's contributed to making it such an expensive operation and logistically difficult just to get out.
How do you think the president is running through all these numbers right now?
If you go back to 2001, when we were just beginning the operation in Afghanistan, we had a balanced budget at that time. So if you look at all the decisions in between, you know, I think that's how we gradually evolved to the situation that we're in today, where the deficit has become a top domestic priority. I think there's increasing pressure to bring down government spending by whatever means necessary.
Todd Harrison, fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, thank you.
Thank you.
The International Trade Commission is expected to rule tomorrow on a patent dispute. The argument involves Apple, BlackBerry, and Kodak, which owns a photo previewing patent. As Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports, there could be big developments from this one.
If you have a smartphone, you've probably used the camera.
Okay, I'm zeroing in on the tree outside my office window. Here we go. Take the photo.
That grainy preview that shows up before you take the picture, Kodak holds a patent for that process. Kodak claims Apple and BlackBerry maker RIM are using its technology without paying for it. Dan Ravisher is the executive director of the Public Patent Foundation.
You can get patents on very small components of products. So your typical cell phone could be covered by hundreds, if not thousands, of patents.
Law professor Jack Lerner says the technology has become standard on cell phones with cameras.
They need the technology to make a competitive phone.
Lerner says companies sometimes try to sneak by without paying the licensing fees. For Apple and BlackBerry, with millions of phones on the market, it makes more sense to invest in good lawyers.
It can cost anywhere from $3 to $5 million to fight an average patent. But these companies are looking at hundreds of million dollars in licensing fees. So it makes sense to fight this as much as you can.
The International Trade Commission could prevent Apple and RIM from importing phones that are assembled overseas. Attorney Paul Ackerman with Dorsey & Whitney says Kodak had a lot at stake.
I think that this intellectual property revenue is absolutely critical to their continued business models.
Kodak could gain another $1 billion. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Well, the Mortgage Bankers Association said this morning applications for mortgages dropped last week despite an average interest rate of 4.5% for a standard 30-year home loan.
One of the hurdles to buying a house, Steve, is a 20% minimum down payment, and that is something that lawmakers have proposed as part of the new financial reform law. Well, today, a bipartisan group of lawmakers will say that hurdle is too high. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
At 20%, the buyer of an average-priced home would have to bring $40,000 cash to closing. Barry Ziggis with the Consumer Federation of America says that puts homeownership out of reach.
The proposed regulation would consign an entire class of renters today to being renters for a very long time.
But regulators say no or low down payments are why so many homebuyers now owe more than their property is worth. Peter Wallison at the American Enterprise Institute says homebuyers need to put more skin in the game.
When a home buyer puts more money into the home in the form of a down payment, the home buyer has made a commitment to the home and is likely to stay with that commitment.
The Consumer Federation's Barry Ziggis says borrowers shouldn't suffer for the sins of banks.
We think the current crisis was caused by the complete abandonment of responsible underwriting principles.
Consumer groups say strengthen lending standards, but leave minimum down payments alone. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Well, now to Silicon Valley. With the recent initial public offerings from LinkedIn and Pandora, you know about those, Jeremy, and
yep.
the coming IPOs from Groupon and Facebook, seems like the IPO market is going haywire right now, right? But a survey out this morning finds venture capitalists don't think so at all. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman has that story.
Talk about euphoria. Did you watch LinkedIn's IPO launch?
Anytime you see an IPO pop that much on the first
You can be forgiven for thinking all this euphoria means the whole startup economy is in good shape.
We've gone from a D-minus to a C+.
That's Mark Heeson of the National Venture Capital Association. Its survey finds 9 out of 10 venture capitalists think the financial markets are still too weak to support a lot of IPOs. The number of IPOs is up a bit this year, but Heeson says it's still half what's needed, and cautious investors only have eyes for the likes of Facebook and Groupon.
By no means to denigrate what's happening in the social media space, but we're seeing life science companies, medical devices, still having a hard time to go public. Our clean tech companies, they're job creators, they're innovative. These are companies that could go international.
What has gone international, companies from China, India, and Russia have launched some of the most successful recent IPOs. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Steve, some industries are cutting back in this economy, but not the bourbon industry in Kentucky. Distilleries there have been spending millions of dollars expanding to quench the worldwide thirst for bourbon.
Yeah.
In fact, about 5 million barrels of the stuff are aging right now in the state. That is the highest level since the early 80s. And since the state has a population of 4.3 million people, it is now easier to find a barrel of bourbon than a resident in the state of Kentucky.
Every resident of Kentucky can now claim a
barrel
of bourbon. They can all have a barrel of bourbon and then some to send right here to California. You know what the organizers of the 2012 London Olympics don't want me to say, Jeremy?
What?
2012.
Really?
Apparently they have taken kindly to it, and they are really sensitive about anyone else who's going to say it. A British company called Great Exhibition 2012 just beat back a legal challenge, and they're going to be able to keep the year 2012 in its name. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story from London.
With a global spotlight on the London Olympics next year, 2012 seemed a good time to promote Britain. So a group of business people launched the Great Exhibition of 2012. It's a 2-week festival designed to celebrate UK industry, art and architecture. But the Olympic lawyers stepped in and threatened legal action. They claimed that by using the date 2012 in its title, the company was infringing on the Olympic trademark. Rachel Griffiths of the Great Exhibition Company.
What we have here is an opportunity to celebrate everything that's great about Britain when the eyes of the world will be upon us. We have absolutely no intention to cash in on the Olympics.
The Olympic lawyers have now backed down. The Great Exhibition Company will be allowed to use the date 2012. The lawyers are now reported to be pursuing a butcher who designed a logo involving 5 interlinked rings of sausages. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, the 4th of July is less than 2 weeks away, and AAA said this morning that holiday travel will be down 2.5% this year because of high gas prices. About 3 million Americans are expected to take to the skies for the holiday. But if you've tried to buy an airline ticket recently, even on a discount carrier like Southwest or JetBlue, you know it's not as easy as it used to be to find the really great deals. For more on this, let's bring in LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, David, is cheap air travel a thing of the past?
Well, it's looking that way, in part because the airlines have figured out more and more ways to reach into your pocket through excess fees, but also because higher fuel costs. It just keeps going up, and that in turn forces the airlines to continually raise their ticket prices almost on a weekly, if not monthly, basis.
And it doesn't look like fuel costs are going to come way down anytime soon. So is there any cheap way for people to get away if they need to?
Well, your best bet at this point is to prowl around online. And it used to be you could look at the various online travel agencies like Expedia, and that's kind of changing a bit. A lot of airlines want to take a lesson from Southwest, which likes to keep all its ticketing in-house and not play along with those travel agencies. And so more and more, if you want to find last-minute seats at a bargain price, not that there's a lot because they're flying fewer flights these days, but if they are to be found, often you'll find them at the airline's own website. So what you might want to do is find an airline online that you like, that you want to be monogamous with, and then look around their website and learn how you can get in there real quick at the last minute and see if there are any seats available.
But for those people who can't find something like that and end up having to spend more time at home and not being able to get away to the beach or whatever, is there a bigger economic effect because of less vacation?
Well, yeah, there is. The Commerce Department estimates that tourism accounts for about $1.3 trillion in economic output in the U.S., supports about 8.2 million U.S. jobs. So it's a big deal. When Americans stay home, a lot of people feel it. On the other hand, there are ways to do this with a budget in mind. For example, you don't have to stay in a hotel. More and more people are doing home swaps as a way to travel, not just domestically, but also internationally. You can go to all sorts of websites like homeexchange.com that'll teach you how to do that. So I think there are ways to cut corner and still fulfill your wanderlust.
Are you swapping your home this summer, David?
Not a chance. I don't want strangers in my house.
Okay. LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And finally, Jeremy, has this ever happened to you? You're on an airplane. It's dark. You want to read your magazine or your book, maybe the Sky Mall catalog. Huh? That's right in that seat, the pouch right in front of you. You reach for the reading light button and you call the flight attendant instead.
Yeah,
that is a big oops. How embarrassing for you, by the way. Well, Boeing says it's come up with a miraculous solution for this. Hmm. On its new 737s, the attendant call and the reading light buttons have been placed far apart from one another. They're not next to each other. They're not next to each other anymore. Can you believe it? And they actually look different.
I'm glad that the makers of the airplanes are finally focusing on what's really important.
The team got together and they said, we need to really fix the important stuff, and that's one of them right there.
Well, in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.